Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, April 10th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the local coronavirus story and more with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from WCAI's Sam Houghton and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner. We'll check in with Ethan Genter at the Cape Cod Times and Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Speak with Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette. And we'll hear from Mike Dean up at the State House. We'll finish off by speaking with WCAI's Jeanette Barnes. Each week is bringing an enormous amount of news. To help us get a handle on it, WCAI Sam Houghton starts us off with an overview of the latest numbers and information on the local coronavirus response. Good morning, Sam.
Hey, Steve. How's it going?
Sam, tell us where we stand today.
Yeah, right now we're nearing 19,000 cases of the virus across the state. That's more than double where we were on Friday for the last roundup. Some 500 people have now died, but kind of the weird news, it'll likely get exponentially worse in the coming weeks. Today is actually day one of Governor Baker's projected surge in cases. He said we could have anywhere between 50,000 and, I guess, 170,000 cases over the course of the pandemic, and a lot of that is expected to happen in the next 2 weeks. On the Cape, there are now about 450 cases. That's up about 200 from last week. We had a story this morning that shows the majority of cases here are on the Upper Cape. Bristol County is approaching 1,000 cases. That's more than double from last week. And then on the islands, maybe some of the only positive news we've really heard this week, there's only 22 cases in total, 12 on the Vineyard and 10 on Nantucket.
What are people saying about these numbers from the islands? You would imagine this could be interpreted as an optimistic sign.
Yeah. I sat in a press conference with MV Hospital administrators. They say they're cautiously optimistic, that kind of their stay-at-home order is working. But they say it's not a time to kind of relax or be complacent. They're by no means out of the woods there. People should keep social distancing and going out only for essentials.
Sam, another big story this week was ventilators. You spoke with Senator Markey about the lack of ventilators provided from the federal stockpile.
Yeah, Markey says there's about 9,000 in the federal stockpile, but Massachusetts has only gotten 100 so far. He says we're projected to run out of those pretty soon before the peak in our surge. Governor Baker said last week the executive branch of the government would send Massachusetts 1,700 ventilators. Markey and the state's congressional delegation, they've been kind of hounding FEMA, asking, you know, why haven't we gotten what we asked for and what really the state needs.
Locally, one of the ways that the region has planned for a surge is field hospitals and also these kind of step-down facilities. Some locations were announced this week. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we got kind of hints of this last week. This was going to happen, but Governor Baker announced on Sunday that Joint Base Cape Cod would be a kind of a field hospital. We also slowly learned over this week that two nursing homes in the Cape, so it's going to be Royal on Main Street in Falmouth and Wingate in Brewster. They're going to be converted for kind of non-critical patients with the virus. It's about 300 beds in total on those facilities. And we also learned yesterday that two nursing homes in New Bedford, they would be converted as well, something like 200 beds in total from those facilities.
That is WCAI's Sam Houghton rounding up the local response to get us started today. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Steve.
For many families, today marks the end of the fourth week since schools closed in an effort to slow the spread of coronavirus. That means 4 weeks with kids at home. For some school districts, this past week brought the first formalized efforts at teaching online. WCAI's Eve Zuckoff joins us now to talk about that. Good morning, Eve.
Good morning, Steve.
Eve, they call it required remote learning. Falmouth and Nantucket started it this week. What do we know about how it's going?
Well, we're just a week in, so I don't think anything conclusive yet, but I've heard week one actually went great. It had some of that kind of nervous excitement that comes often with returning to school in the fall. It kind of brought that feeling with it. And the goal this week was really just to get connected, get back into a routine, and use these much shorter face-to-face check-ins to be together rather than recreate a traditional class. But teachers have told me they're working harder than ever, maybe to really adapt, to create shorter lessons, to be there for their students. And part of that is they're supporting students academically and really emotionally. Students are asking their trusted adults questions about spring sports and graduation and so many things in the future where there just aren't great answers yet.
We don't yet know what's going to happen in terms of getting kids back into classrooms this year. So what are you hearing from teachers about their hopes and fears for the school year?
Yeah, so I mean, already in Pennsylvania, the state of Pennsylvania has closed their schools for the remainder of the school year. We do not yet know what we'll do in our state. But the hope that I heard from a few teachers is to return to routine, get connection to these students. And it's not necessarily extraordinary academic advancement. With the younger students, it's maintaining concepts. With the older students, it's more slowly teaching new concepts and having school really be a buoy. The fear, and something I think we should be watching out for, is what schools will do. It's actually not schools, but at the state level, what will happen with standardized tests, the MCAS. I heard fear that those tests will force teachers to take what little lesson control they have and just completely hijack it. And in these weeks and months before the standardized tests are scheduled, how is a biology teacher, for example, going to give kids that hands-on learning that they need to get some of the knowledge that would be in a standardized test? On the other hand, standardized tests offer important metrics, especially in this time where there aren't that many, that help determine funding and need. So that's going to be a big one that I know teachers are watching.
Eve, this week you also reported on how Jews adjusted to remote Passovers, and you looked into what Christians are doing on Easter Sunday. Give us a sense. What did you hear?
Amazingly similar things. You know, that's partially because there aren't that many options. Everyone is on Zoom. There were so many Zoom Seders. Many were password protected for fear of what people are calling Zoom bombing, kind of hijacking these Zooms. But they were open to congregations, big, big, big numbers of Jews celebrating Seders. And this Sunday for Easter, you know, the Provincetown police are doing a bunny drive-by. So they're driving their police cars down the street
and
having
Eve,
people wave from their window.
They're doing bunny drive-bys?
They have the Easter Bunny is going to be safely driving down down Provincetown streets from his patrol car, waving to people who are safely inside. So there's still a little taste of Easter in Provincetown.
That is great.
It's pretty great.
Yes.
I think the big thing is hope. People are looking for hope from these two religious holidays.
Well, it's an opportunity for us to, as you say, to remember kind of the stories behind these holidays and what they speak to about connection and the importance of it here. WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
On Martha's Vineyard, most towns have had a construction ban in place. What happens when it expires in another week and a half? Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us to talk about just that. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Steve. How's it going?
Brian, tell us about what's being considered here and who it is that's having this conversation.
Sure. So, as many people know, Governor Baker had issued an advisory that had a long list of exemptions for a lot of construction and other kind of work. And that, you know, I'd asked people to stay at home, but kind of let, you know, construction workers and other tradespeople go out to work. Well, here on Martha's Vineyard, island officials weren't really happy with that advisory. So they kind of wanted to go farther and ban construction outright. And five of the six island towns actually did that. And now that they've had that in place for a while, they just extended it for until April 21. The island officials are now working on a plan to kind of phase people back in, tradespeople back into work. So it's not set in stone right now. This working group developed a draft of guidelines, and it would kind of look like having, one up to a maximum of two people back on a construction site or a work site at a time. They would have to practice social distancing, proper hand washing techniques. They would have to put up signage at some construction sites showing how to wash your hands and kind of with some other knowledge of how to social distance.
Brian, one of the big things here, though, is about it deals with transportation to and from job sites.
Yeah, correct. So there's a clause in there that says people can go to work either by walking, by taking their bike, or by taking their vehicle, but they can be the only person in there. And it specifically states people are not allowed to take the bus or the ferry to their construction or work site. So essentially, that would not allow anyone coming from off island to come here to work on a construction site. And many people, who take the bus as well.
Is there, do you get a sense from the construction community how they're responding to these changes in rules? Not bringing in people from off island is a big change for a lot of the jobs that must be ongoing on the island.
Yeah, of course. So a lot of construction people have actually kind of welcomed the ban. They met on a Zoom conference meeting last week with the CEO of the hospital, Denise Chappici, and the president of the Martha's Vineyard Builders Association. And they all kind of talked about it to get some more information. And so there's been some acceptance of it. I think people would like to get back to work sooner rather than later, but they are open to this, yeah.
When this is still not set in stone, though, is that right? This is all being developed, so they're not even sure if this is would this take place on the expiration date, April 21st?
Yeah, so this is just a draft of guidelines that a working group, which is made up of building commissioners, health officials, and tradespeople, they kind of have been working on this for a while, and it's just a draft right now, and no one's voted it in yet, but they're looking to get it passed in each of the island towns.
A little bit earlier, we heard about numbers on the island for coronavirus, and they seem pretty low and pretty stable. What's the feeling there about how the island is faring right now?
So people are, adhering to social distancing and proper hand washing and everything, because of course right now we only have 12 cases on the island, and that number has kind of been steady every couple of days. It seems like it goes up one or two, but yeah, people are, adhering to things and trying to stay home and looking forward to this being over.
That is Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
This is the news roundup on The Point. We're going around the region today talking about the local impacts of the coronavirus and how communities are meeting the challenge. I'm Steve Junker. There are many government programs offering loans and assistance during the pandemic, so many that it can be difficult for small business owners or an individual to know where to turn. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us to talk about one group trying to help sort it all out. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, you start this off in the paper by saying a person can easily drown in paperwork and a confusion of acronyms.
Yeah, as anybody who has had to deal with the government bureaucracy when they're having a little bit of trouble during normal times has found out that, that's the case. And now, especially as you said, with all the programs that have been instituted to provide assistance and relief during this pandemic, it's even more overwhelming. You know, if you're self-employed or a sole proprietor of businesses, do you apply for a loan from the Small Business Association? Do you go for unemployment through the state? It's just, it can be really overwhelming. Now, Monomoy Community Services in Chatham here, thanks to some generous donations, they've hired Morgan Eldridge to be a community resource advocate to help people really navigate through this bureaucratic waters. She's available by phone or video conferencing for people, either individuals or business owners, and she'll help you determine which program can help. And she'll also help you figure out what kind of paperwork and documentation you need, and connect you with people with other services that could also help. It's an area that Morgan knows really well. Her other job is with the Fishing Partnership, which is a nonprofit that covers New England, and she's a navigator with that group, basically connecting fishermen with health insurance and those type of services. So she knows how to get to the programs, she understands the programs, and she's really schooled herself on these new programs that are out there now. And you can find details on how to get in touch with Morgan in our newspaper, on our website, or by contacting Monomoy Community Services.
Hey, I want to ask you about another story you have in the paper this week. This is a story about how Cape Codders are using 3D printing to help the coronavirus response.
Yeah, there's a group on the Cape called the Cape Cod Makers, and they're a non-profit group of hobbyists, and they have a maker space at the Harwich Cultural Center. And when the whole coronavirus situation hit and healthcare organizations realized they needed more personal protection gear, they were contacted and asked if they could help. And the club's leader, Mike Looney, contacted a friend who had been making face shields, basically using a 3D printer to print out a plastic visor. And Mike and other club members were able to tweak the design so that they could attach plastic sheets to the front of the visors, making them into a face shield. And those plastic sheets, the way they design them, they're replaceable, making these very, very useful. It's interesting, for the plastic sheets, they are using overhead projector sheets, if you remember those from school. Well, people don't use overhead projectors in school anymore, so many of the Cape school districts have boxes of these things sitting around. So right now there are about 40 or more individuals around the Cape cranking out these visors, you know, including school STEM teachers like Matt Barnes at Monomoy Middle School. You have individuals at home, and they've cranked out about 2,000 of these visors, and their goal is to get about 5,000 of them out to Cape Cod Healthcare and emergency workers and others around the Cape.
5,000 is a big number, Tim.
It's a big number. And, you know, when you think that it takes about an hour and a half to make each of these visors, if you understand 3D printing, it's a slow process. It's a layer of plastic on a layer of plastic over and over again. But they've got so many of these machines working now that Mike Looney said he's confident that they'll be able to make that goal. And he said they'll just keep making them and supplying them to anybody who needs them as long as the situation lasts.
What a great way for folks to get involved and be able to support the effort there.
Sure, yeah, it makes them feel helpful, and as Matt Barnes from Monomoy Middle School told us, it allows them to really exercise their geek muscles.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Food security is a real issue as we make our way through this April of our pandemic. In Truro, some residents have begun to pitch in together to help others out. From the Provincetown Banner, we're joined now by Marianne Bragg with the story. Hi, Marianne.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's nice to see the sunshine today, Marianne. Tell us about the Truro. What's that?
I said I'm going to be watching out for that Easter bunny on Sunday.
out here in Provincetown.
The drive-by Easter Bunny. tell us about the Truro Community Kitchen and what's happening here.
Well, let's see. So literally about a week and a half ago, three people with an idea, Wendy Lurie, her adult child, Eli Sobel, and then Julie Grandy, who co-owns the Box Lunch, came together to create a nonprofit. It's called Truro Community Kitchen, and they're now, as of last Sunday, they produced, I think it was about 80 meals for people who are particularly in need, and it's really designed just for during this time of the coronavirus. And so, actually, I just spoke with Wendy a few minutes ago, and they're serving a weekly meal on Sundays. It's either pick up or delivered to a home. And so last Sunday was 80, and now they're looking at 98 meals for this coming Sunday.
This came together incredibly quickly.
Yes, they're super powerful people in a sense of, you know, making things happen. As I was looking over what we had written, the three towns out here, so Wellfleet, Truro, and Provincetown, each one, the schools provide free food during the weeks for children and their families. And then it somewhat leaves the weekend a little bit open for food. So each town has really gone about it slightly differently. In Wellfleet, there's a restaurant that's just serving a breakfast, pickup breakfast. In Truro now, there's the community kitchen, which where the meals are cooked there at Box Lunch in Truro, and then can either pick up or have it delivered. And then Soup Kitchen in Provincetown also has kind of weekend meals to go.
Marianne, let me ask you about another story in the paper, or a whole other section of the paper, I guess, really, live events. And these are a thing now of the past, for a little while anyway. But at the paper, you've got a sizable listing for virtual events. Tell us about this.
Well, I wouldn't say it's sizable.
But, well, it's growing, right?
growing. So on March 12th, I was looking back. So on March 12th was like a normal paper where we'd had an entire page, like 53 locations where all kinds of arts and entertainment events were happening. So that was like a month ago. Then the next week, we went down to absolutely no listings for March 19th. Then in the weeks to follow, we started to grow with like three listings, four listings. So this week, I think we're up to 12, and they're all of them literally are kind of live streamed concerts. One of them is a drive-by art exhibit in Truro. And the two cinemas, well, actually a cinema in Provincetown and then at Wellfleet Preservation Hall, they're have scheduled movies that you can watch through their website. And now this Saturday, there's going to be a Mosquito Story Slam live streamed through the Provincetown Theater website.
Marianne Bragg joining us from the Provincetown Banner. Thanks, Marianne.
Thank you, Steve.
Ridership is down on transportation providers across the region, and that's put them in a pinch. Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times joins us now with that story. Good morning, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve.
Ethan, describe some of these different transportation providers and tell us about how there is some help for these coming from the federal government now.
Yeah, so a lot of people have probably heard about the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, which is commonly renowned as the CARES Act. And so that's going to be sending some money to a lot of different providers in a lot of different parts of the economy. It's about $2 trillion in total. But here on the Cape, transportation-wise, there's going to be money going to the Steamship Authority, which is the ferry service from the mainland to the islands. It's a quasi-public agency. And then there's the Cape Cod Regional Transit Authority, which they run a bus service that largely goes kind of, they have a fixed service route that goes throughout the Cape, and they have some other different types of services.
The numbers on of riders now must be, I can't even imagine who's how busy these operations really are right now. Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, the Steamship Authority has seen a super sharp decline. As earlier in the program, they talked about kind of the construction bans on the Vineyard. I mean, that's really the main clientele at this time of the year, is contractors, workers, people who either work on the mainland and live on the island or live on the mainland and work on the island. So it's kind of, that's usually the bulk of that, and it's almost dropped off entirely. The Steamship Authority, so unlike a lot of other state-mandated or state-run things, the Steamship Authority makes all of their money, their whole budget comes almost entirely from the ticket sales. So they are in a real pinch because it's going to be soon where they kind of turn the corner. They run at a deficit for most of the year until summer comes, and then they kind of dig themselves out of that hole, and there's a real worry there that that corner is not going to turn when it usually does this time of year. So to combat that, they have furloughed about 100 employees. They hope to bring them back later once things kind of get sunnier again.
Hey, Ethan, you also reported this week on the death of John Peroni, a popular DJ at WOMR in Provincetown. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, so John was known in pretty well in Provincetown by a lot of different circles as well as kind of around the world for one certain segment. He was a kind of a famous Motown DJ at the radio station. He also worked at he was a nurse for a long while. Worked at Cape Ann Manor and Seashore Point. He had been sick for a few weeks and then was brought to Cape Cod Hospital on Sunday. He had tested positive for COVID, and then he died later on Sunday. And it was kind of, a lot of people were kind of shocked. A lot of people hadn't heard from him in a bit. But yeah, he was very famous. He was known for his extended mixes of Motown hits. He was kind of a Motown lifer. I listened to Four Tops Bernadette last night. It was quite good. If anyone has some time to listen,
John Peroni will be missed, and I think a lot of people felt touched by his passing. Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times. Ethan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much, Steve.
A sad note on Nantucket this week as the island saw its first death related to coronavirus. Josh Balling is with us now from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, not a lot of information here, but this is something I'm sure no one wanted to see.
Certainly not. No one ever wants to see anything like this, obviously. But yes, the patient, a man in his 80s with a pre-existing medical condition, died late Sunday at Nantucket Cottage Hospital. Another patient has also been transferred to a mainland facility for a higher level of care. But on the good news note, since testing began, there have only been 10 positive cases reported on the island, and yesterday marked the sixth straight day with no new cases reported on Nantucket. As of this time, or as of yesterday afternoon anyway, 185 nasal swabs from Nantucket had been sent to state labs for testing. In addition to those 10 positive tests, 169 of them have come back negative, and six are awaiting results. Hospital officials, town officials, and public health officials all agree that 10 confirmed cases in a community the size of Nantucket is certainly good news, but they're all stressing that this is a direct result of the efforts and the sacrifices Nantucketers have made as far as social distancing goes and limiting contact goes, and the town's very strict stay-at-home order and construction and landscaping bans, which are even stricter than the state rules. And they say those need to continue into the foreseeable future so that the curve continues to flatten, hopefully no or a limited number of positive cases will continue to be seen, and that down the road, perhaps, things will get back to normal maybe sooner than they are in some other places. But this is obviously having a big impact on businesses. This is the slow time of the year, has been the slow time of the year until just about now. Many businesses normally would be preparing to reopen for the spring, slowly ramp up toward the summer. The Nantucket Daffodil Festival, which has been canceled, is at the end of the month. But now a lot of those businesses are still closed. Even, you know, the essential businesses are the only ones that are allowed to open, and all businesses wondering when they might be allowed to open. It's keeping them from hiring workers, including a lot of foreign workers. A number of students on J-1 visas come over every year, hundreds of them. Those are all on hold for at least 60 days by the order of the government. And H-2B workers, which can come to the States as long as there are no travel restrictions on their entrance. But employers out here who use them, a lot of them, say they're advising them to stay home right now. They don't know when they'll need them, and they don't know exactly when they'll be able to open, how busy they'll be, and if they'll even be available when they do open.
A little positive news amid all of this: the island has a new high school principal.
It does, and schools, while remaining closed, they went to mandatory remote learning this week. The schools did hire a veteran educator from Central Mass, Mandy Vassell. She will replace John Buckey, who has accepted a superintendent position in Marblehead, and she is scheduled to start her new post on July 1st, and school officials certainly hope that she will be able to do that in her office and not from a remote location. She was chosen from a pool of 14 applicants and was far and away the top choice of the search committee and school officials, the deputy superintendent Beth Hallett said.
That is Josh Bowling speaking to us from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thanks a lot, Josh.
Thank you.
This is the news roundup on The Point. We are going around the region today talking about the local impact of the coronavirus and how communities are meeting the challenge. I'm Steve Junker. If someone is confirmed or suspected to have coronavirus, the next job for public officials is to determine who else they might have infected. How does that work? Reporter Noah Asmo takes a look at that in the Vineyard Gazette, and he joins us now. Hey, Noah.
Good, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Noah, I thought this was fascinating. Walk us through the process here. It's called contact tracing.
Yes. Yeah, so just for anyone who doesn't know, and actually just reporting on this, it was interesting to see just, you know, how many people were unfamiliar with the fact that this was happening at all. And it's happening throughout the country. But basically, contact tracing, it's the process of identifying people who may have come into contact with an infected person and then collecting as much information as you possibly can about these people. You know, it's a pretty common practice for things like tuberculosis, small, you know, diseases that don't have as wide a scope as this, but this is sort of unprecedented. And the way it works on the island, at least, was, you know, basically public health officials have had 2 weeks to figure out what is a totally complicated process that involves the hospital, the state, the boards of health, and then the boards of health contracted public health nurses, who are the ones who are actually going out and trying to interview these people. So basically, to give you a sense of what happens just in the beginning, because the hospital is the first organization that gets a positive test result and they conduct most of the tests, it's them who reach out to the public health nurses. It used to be that they'd have to go through the state, and then they'd have to go to the boards of health, who would then reach out. But now it's sort of been streamlined, and they reach out to public health nurses. And there's two of them on the island, and they've so far, you know, we have 12 cases thus far, but they've identified approximately 30 people who qualify as contacts of those cases, and it's their job to track and monitor all of these people as well as the positive cases. And that process is totally complicated as well. But yes, it is, you know, it's an important thing that everyone is sort of taking really seriously here and hoping will help prevent the spread of the disease.
It must be difficult even to determine which level of contacts to trace out here in terms of, I mean, you can imagine people's immediate contacts. If they're in a family group, those people can be presumed to need to quarantine. But what happens to people that you have kind of more passing contact with?
Right. So this is where things do totally get hazy. There's a form, actually, that the Department of Public Health of the state sends out to public health officials throughout Massachusetts. And the form sort of lists this hierarchy of people who could be contacts. You know, of course, the most obvious one is a household contact or someone, you know, who's a family member. They live with you. They've most likely come within 6 feet of you, which is what is sort of the definition of a contact. But then things get a little bit trickier. There's after that, close friends, then there's hospital workers, which are considered high-risk contacts, you know, someone who you might have sat next to in a waiting room. There's workplace exposure, and then there's air travel if that was happening, and there's other forms of community exposure. But talking to the public health officials on the island, there is a line sort of that I think they've been able to figure out and walk, And, you know, a contact is not someone who might have been in the grocery store with you at the same time. It's not someone who might happen to, you know, be checking their P.O. box while you were at the post office. It's different than that. It's someone who has had, you know, a sustained reaction or interaction with you for a period of time. And I think, you know, actually hearing that, you know, it sort of helps me understand how this process works and where really most of the spread is happening, even in a small rural community like the Vineyards. It's, you know, right now, most of the contacts on the island are family members. There are a few who are not, public health officials said, but it's not people who, you know, you just happen to brush by on the street yet. And maybe in some places it is that, but that's not what contact tracing officials on the island have discovered so far.
That is Noah Asimo reporting on the contact tracing process in the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
Another week of quarantine means another week of new orders and efforts by state lawmakers to curb the spread of coronavirus. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean for the latest.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
Mike, so many things have been coming out of Beacon Hill over the past few weeks, whether it's news from the governor or from lawmakers, and we can't even cover all of it during our weekly chat, but I do want to go over some of the bigger things that have happened this week. First, Governor Charlie Baker has done a few things to protect both the healthcare industry and healthcare workers themselves.
Yeah, the major thing that the governor pulled out, there's going to be an $800 million influx of funds to the state's hospital system, healthcare system. It's going to be $400 million for hospitals, $300 million to other healthcare providers that keep people out of hospitals, which is just as important, and then $80 million for nursing homes, and the other $20 million is kind of scattered around. Basically, a lot of this is federal aid that's coming in, as well as a lot of the mass health Medicaid money that would have been spent on things like elective surgeries and other procedures that are being held off because of the crisis. So all of this, the healthcare spending the state isn't doing because of the crisis, is kind of being redirected to help support these hospital systems and honestly help these providers stay in business. One thing that we haven't really thought about too much is that they still have payrolls to make. They have cash flow issues as well. So this is going to be an influx of funds to stabilize that industry through the surge and through hopefully the remainder of the crisis so that we don't have the really unfortunate situation where, you know, nurses or doctors can't be paid because of a cash flow problem that occurs at one of these larger hospital chains.
Yeah, these nurses and doctors are risking a lot. And, you know, if you think there's any worry that hospitals may not be able to pay them, you can see why the governor is moving fast.
Absolutely. And you got to remember, Charlie Baker, a former health insurance guy, ran a health insurance company for a very long time. He describes himself as a healthcare guy, if not a physician himself. It does not need legislative approval because it's all kind of that mass health money and money that he can appropriate himself. So I expect that to go through in the coming weeks. The other thing that was put out is that there is a bill that will go through the legislature that's going to protect doctors, nurses, other medical workers from liability issues that come up during this crisis. A lot of folks are working at the front lines outside of a normal hospital setting. We're looking at the you know, nursing homes that are converted into COVID-19 care centers. A lot of these, you know, hospitals that have been rearranged. A lot of the care centers that are being built in places like the DCU Center in Worcester, the Boston Convention Center in South Boston. There's still talks about Joint Base Cape Cod hosting a COVID-19 care center. So this bill would protect workers from, you know, liability when they need to honestly make life and death decisions about where care needs to go, especially as we hit the surge in the coming week or so.
Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito was also in the news this week. She announced new restrictions at grocery stores.
Yeah, so this is new guidance from the Department of Public Health that says that grocery stores should really be capped at 40% of their capacity, meaning that the employees and the shoppers, it needs to be 40% of that building's capacity. So this is really what's going to, you know, add to those lines of 6-foot distancing that you see outside of grocery stores now. So this is evolving guidance from the state on exactly what the grocery stores should be doing. I think most of it is still an advisory. It's not mandatory. You know, one of the problems that we've been seeing is that there's really no way to enforce a lot of this stuff. People just kind of have to go along and do it. But because grocery stores have really become the front line, aside from the hospital care system, a lot of folks are seeing, you know, outbreaks or grocery store workers themselves coming down with the illness. At least one grocery store worker in Massachusetts has died. So we're not only trying to protect people who may be visiting grocery stores as their only trip out the door, but also protecting those grocery store workers themselves.
I want to now look to the House and Senate. They've been doing the best they can to try to get work done while also social distance. And I heard they had a little glitch this week.
Yeah, the budget train keeps rolling. It's been, you know, somewhat derailed. So lawmakers have to get the state budget in at a certain time this spring. It's a multi-step process. It has been completely sidelined by this crisis because they don't know what state revenue is going to look like. They don't know what the state is going to need to spend. Tuesday was going to be the first big budget hearing. They were going to have a roundtable discussion. The Ways and Means budget chairman from the legislature at the State House teleconferencing with a bunch of economists and different folks for their forecast of what was going to happen and what steps the state needed to take through the budget. It didn't happen because they couldn't get the webcast to work. They couldn't get it fed through the legislature's website. So that snafu delayed that for another week. It's going to be on Tuesday now. You know, those talks will probably still be continuing. I think that those budget chairmen still have an idea of what direction they're going to go into, but the public isn't going to see it until at least Tuesday.
And that's WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking with us from Boston. Mike, have a great weekend and get some rest.
Thank you.
And that is WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean at the State House. Cape Cod Healthcare is working to open a field hospital for COVID-19 at Joint Base Cape Cod, plus two other COVID facilities and nursing homes on the Cape. WCAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us now to bring us up to date on this and other related news. Hi, Jeanette.
Good morning, Steve.
Jeanette, you were on a media call yesterday with Cape Cod Healthcare. What did you hear about this push to create a field hospital and convert these nursing facilities?
Right. So Cape Cod Hospital, Cape Cod Healthcare has been asked by the state to open the field hospital at Joint Base Cape Cod, which is expected to have 124 beds. Plus, they're opening two other COVID facilities in nursing homes. That's the Royal Falmouth Nursing Home and the Wingate in Brewster. These are essentially for people who are kind of in a step-down status. They've either been discharged from the hospital or do not have a serious enough case to really need the hospital itself.
So that's a lot of beds, I'm imagining, right? At the field hospital, we're talking about 124 beds, then more beds at both nursing facilities.
It's Mike Loft, he's the CEO of Cape Cod Healthcare, says it's essentially 320 beds. The nursing home facilities are expected to open within the next 2 weeks or so. He says 3 to 5 days for one, 7 to 10 days for the other. On the field hospital, there was kind of almost an exasperated tone on the line when people asked when that would be opening. He said this really is a really big undertaking for an organization like Cape Cod Healthcare, and he just doesn't know exactly when that's going to open. But he says they have experts out there that are working hard on it. The thing is that it's not just like you sort of throw up some beds and unlock the door. There are all kinds of things they need to have in place so that patients will be in a safe and appropriate setting, things like oxygen and, you know, all the things that go into a regular hospital setting.
I can only imagine that Cape Cod Healthcare is already going full force in trying to manage its two hospitals in the COVID response. And now they're being asked to really essentially set up these almost in a whole nother hospital system, as you say.
Right. He says, you know, we don't have the resources that they have in Boston. They've assured the governor that they can get this done, but they're just going to do as much as they can. But it's a pretty big lift.
Now, New Bedford is pursuing a similar strategy we heard this week. They also are looking at turning former nursing homes into COVID care centers.
Right. So in that case, the city of New Bedford is leasing two nursing home buildings that closed last year. They're working with South Coast Hospitals, which, of course, owns the three hospitals down there, and also with a local nursing home operator that's actively operating other nursing homes. They're going to be running it. Those are getting kind of set up and cleaned out. April 14th is the day that they expect to begin transferring patients.
That's just 4 days from now.
That's right.
Very
well,
soon.
yeah. I mean, I don't know exactly what the state they were in, but they were actively being used as nursing homes until last spring. So the mayor said they're working on, you know, sprucing them up, making sure they're clean. He said they even worked on the landscaping because they want people to feel like this is an attractive place to go rather than say, oh, no, I'm going to go home, because then you could infect your family.
You also spoke this week with a nurse at Cape Cod Hospital and heard a little bit about how the staff there is coping. Tell us about this conversation.
Right. So I spoke to the co-chair of the Registered Nurses Union, that's the Mass Nurses Association. She says they really are anxious, the nurses, the other frontline employees, they really are anxious about not having enough supplies if they eventually do run out, and about infecting their families. She says right now they really do have enough. They do have enough at the moment of the things that they need, the masks and gloves and protective gear. But many are worried about transmitting the virus when they go home to people. Some people may have, you know, people in their households who have lowered immunity for whatever reason. And she says they've asked Cape Cod Healthcare for separate lodging for those staff who don't feel safe going home, but they haven't gotten an answer on that yet.
We have just about a minute left. I want to ask you about another story you did this week, and this was a bit of a lighter profile. It's about someone uniquely positioned in all of this. It's Barnstable County's health director. It's a unique role even within the state or New England, apparently.
Right. So Sean O'Brien, he's the county health director, and he does a daily conference call for the media every weekday where he gives kind of a Cape-wide overview of the situation. And I couldn't find another county health director in Massachusetts. I asked him about that. He says he's not sure if there's even one in New England. So in Franklin County, which is very rural in northwestern Mass, they have some towns that have like a voluntary cooperative government that does have a health director, but it's unusual in Massachusetts for sure. And it gives people kind of an opportunity to have that local and yet sort of Cape-wide voice pushing for safety measures like social distancing.
That is WCAI's Jeanette Barnes speaking with us. Jeanette, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from WCAI's Sam Houghton, Eve Zukoff, and Jeanette Barnes there. We spoke with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, Ethan Genter at the Cape Cod Times. We checked in with Josh Bowling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, and heard from Mike Dean up at the State House speaking with Katie Ident. And a big thanks to Dan Treidel back at the studio and to my family for tiptoeing around in the background from my home in Woods Hole. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.